Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's seminar. So this is the second seminar in the series that we are organizing at the European Institute on the new pact on migration and asylum. And specifically, today we are discussing the new pact with regards to returns and EU-Africa migration partnerships. So I am Matilde Rosina. I'm a fellow in international migration in the European Institute. And I'm very pleased to introduce our panel. And today we have Professor Florian Trauner, who is Jean Monnet Chair at the Vrije Universiteit in Brussels and visiting professor at the College of Europe, as well as Dr. Oreva Olapke, who is a research fellow at Ryerson University. And we are very happy to have you with us today. So thank you very much for accepting our invitation. Just before leaving the word to Florian, I would like to say a couple of more administrative notes, just very quickly. So first of all, in terms of the format, we'll first have a presentation from Florian and from Oreva, and this will be followed by a short discussion among the two speakers. Following this, we'll have a Q&A with the audience. So during the Q&A, please just either raise your hand using the raise hand function, or if you could write the question in the chat, then I can pose them to the speakers, or you can, you're also more than welcome to ask them yourselves when I call you. Also, I wanted to let you know that the event is being recorded, and if there are no technical difficulties, it will be made available as a podcast. So without further ado, I'm delighted to hand over to Professor Florian Trauner for his presentation.
Thanks, Matilde, and Eike also for having me here. It's a great pleasure to be part of this panel and to discuss this very topical issue. I'm talking primarily about the concept of return sponsorship, which is the pact's most novel element. Most of my information is informed by a policy brief that I co-authored together with Olivia Sundberg-Diaz with the European Policy Center recently. So if I may shamelessly use the opportunity as well to refer to this publication if you're interested to go a bit deeper than this 10 minutes presentations. So the question is, you know, what's basically in this concept, and then a kind of a forward-looking exercise, can this concept actually work according to the ideas that the Commission had? But let's start a bit more widely with the Commission Pact. It was published in September 2020. It's a very comprehensive package, more than 370 pages. So there are a lot of details. But the key idea is that this is the basis for a new and better functioning pan-European migration management system. Everybody, every member state has to contribute to the functioning of the system. And contrary to previous ideas, the states no longer have the big idea previously, let's start differently. The big idea differently was that each member state has to support the border states, Greece, Italy, that have a particular standing and particular responsibilities in the EU's asylum system by relocating asylum seekers. This has become very controversial. So the big idea here in the pact is this will no longer be mandatory. If states do not want to relocate asylum seekers, they can opt for the concept of return sponsorships. So states that pursue a more restrictive migration policy may engage more in the return field. States that are more liberal-minded, they may choose for a mix-up between relocation of asylum seekers and returning irregular migrants. The concept is very closely interlinked with some key ideas. That much more should happen basically at the border of the EU. There should be centers. In the centers, there should be accelerated procedure, very quickly being clear if a migrant is eligible for international protection or not. The EU's agency, Frontex, the European Asylum Support Office, also Europol, they will get much more empowered and much more involved. There should be a very strong control dimension. And again, it's everything very closely interlinked with the return field. So this should be very quickly decided, basically. And then the migrants that are not eligible to stay, they should be returned very quickly. And here I come to the third point. I think Oreva will talk very strongly about this. The whole thing, the whole idea is based on the belief that third countries will have to do more as well. The EU struggles to have high return rates. It basically is always between 35 and 40% on average. So the EU says we have to make third countries cooperate more on, in particular, the return of their own nationals, some neighboring states also on the return of transit migrants. And we may do so by using more positive or negative conditionality. What is a positive conditionality? The positive is basically incentives, you know, more money. You can also consider legal quotas for migrants, but this is a competence for member states, but you could use this in EU negotiations. So positive incentives and negative conditionalities implies that you use a punchier approach. The EU is working, for instance, with visa policies. They have recently revised their visa code, saying that if a state refuses to cooperate on return, then the whole citizens may get tougher visa requirements, visa procedures to get into the European Union. So the whole population may have negative consequences if the government is not cooperating on return. So let's make it, or let's zoom into this return sponsorship. I mean, it's not yet decided, but I think that's the basic idea. Olivia and I have done this a few interviews with officials, and this is how we understand that it could work. So there is a group of Nigerian migrants found eligible directly at the border after, you know, quick procedures. They are then basically physically in Sicily. Let's say they came to Sicily. And Belgium said, okay, I in part of the solidarity mechanism, I take over the responsibility in the context of a return sponsorship. So how is it working concretely? The legal responsibilities for issuing an order to leave will always remain, or at least in the beginning, will remain with Italy. Italy is in charge of all the documentation and legal responsibilities. But Belgium comes to the legal authorities and says, okay, how can I help? And then the Italian authorities say, look, it would be very nice to have an assisted voluntary return program. Can you pay for it, for instance? Or can you go to the Nigerian consulate, get the documentation, the laissez-faire documents that we need to return them? This kind of help could all come into question depending on the needs that Italian authorities may voice. And the process between Italy and Belgium shall be smoothened and facilitated by EU return coordinator. This is a position not yet existing, but this will be basically set into being, and the person should then coordinate and cooperate. So what could be the possible outcomes? Outcome one, the return is possible. They get the paperwork. Somehow, you know, either the migrants are convinced to return voluntarily, or they are subject to a forcible return procedure. Frontex may come in very much in the context of a joint return flight. This kind of helps. So return is possible. Second scenario, return is not possible. Then this group of migrants will be brought, transferred physically from Sicily to Belgium. Usually the deadline for doing so is 8 months, but in case of a crisis, this could be reduced to 4 months. Who defines what is a crisis? This is very much up to the European Commission to say right now we're in a crisis moment or not. But this is, in a nutshell, a bit simplified, the idea of return sponsorship. What is the background? How did we come to end up with such a strong focus on return issues in the European, in the Pact on Migration? In Europe, we have an issue that the asylum applications are very unequally distributed in the European Union. And Aiko, I think he has worked many years already on burden sharing and all these kind of issues. It's a long-standing issue. It's a big challenge for the European Union. Here in these slides, you see the asylum applications for some selected member states. So you can see that the blue color, for instance, is Germany. So in absolute numbers, most asylum applications are still done in Germany. In relative numbers, it's different countries. During the crisis, it was Sweden. Right now, Maltese has by far, in relative terms, most asylum applications. But you can also see here that in recent years, the application rates of Spain, Italy, and France have really gone up. Germany is no longer such an outlier compared to other states. But more widely, you can see that there is quite some fluctuation, and it's certainly not equally distributed. And you can also see, I think this is also revealing, it's a bit counterintuitive, because a pillar of the EU system is the Dublin system, which says that basically the first country of entry is responsible for asylum applications. So this, you would assume, is in most instances Greece and Italy, but Greece and Italy don't have the highest numbers. And there has been a lot of policy debate, academic debate, if one of the reasons is that these states, the state authorities, they wave through migrants a bit to other states and don't control that strictly. And then to get this, or to get back the more regulated managed system as it is framed, the European Union has already post migration crisis of 2015, 2016, worked on a twofold approach, if you want to say so. On the one hand, migrants shall remain at hotspots directly at the border. So in Greece and Italy, so there should be much less opportunities for migrants to go on own initiative towards northern member states. But in exchange for giving more responsibility to these border states, they shall be supported. And they shall be supported by physically bringing people away from Greece and Italy. And in the context of the crisis, they made this relocation, emergency relocation mechanism, was up to 160,000 people. In the end, they just tried to relocate 60,000 people. So here it was meant to last for 2 years. Here you have the numbers. So it's about half of the people the Commission was hoping to get away from Greece and Italy that were transferred. So I think it's not a complete failure, but it's definitely also not a complete success. And some states have entirely refused to work on this. It's very well known that these were Visegrad countries, so Hungary, Poland, but they were joined by some other states as well that were very reluctant to cooperate. Denmark, Austria are two of the examples here. So the idea is right now that the Commission, okay, we take into account that relocation is too contentious, is not working. Let's go right now for return sponsorship as a missing piece of the migration management. And then those states that don't cooperate on relocation, they can do their part in the return sponsorship. Is this working? Right now, we look at the current negotiations. As we speak, they are ongoing. And you can already see some political fault lines. For Visegrad countries, for Austria, Denmark, states that were very skeptical on the concept of relocation, you can see that they remain skeptical of the concept of return sponsorship as well. They say it's a kind of a relocation through the backdoor, because in the end, you will have to transfer migrants physically away from Greece and Italy. So a key objective, and this was very clearly made in our interviews, is that this obligation shall not be in the final outcome of the migration pact. And the opposite is true then for border states. They say 8 months is a very long time. Why not reduce it to 4 or 6 months and to make it more tangible, to make it more predictable? So the solidarity provisions need to be strengthened. So it continues this conflict. It's too much for some and not enough for the others. And then the second point is that the Commission, in view of year-long conflicts, they said, okay, let's avoid, you know, the too tangible details, conflictual details. They have opted for a lot of flexibility. So member states can really even define which nationalities they would like to sponsor. And here again, I mean, some countries are known to take back their citizens relatively easily, you know, Eastern European partners, for instance, and some states, African partners, they have hardly anyone to take back. So, I mean, if a state in the center has to choose a sponsor, a nationality to take basically responsibility in this return sponsorship, it's rational to choose nationalities that are easier to be returned. It's also less predictable for border states what shall be, you know, what kind of contribution they can expect, you know, what is the ratio between relocation and other things. And there is a lot of ongoing negotiations about these possibilities. And if you think the concept through, you can see that there is a lot of possibility to shirk or shift responsibilities and to avoid the actual implementation of the concepts. And then there are two other points. First one, what is the role of migrants? And here again, you may say that this concept creates new vulnerabilities for migrants. There is a big difference in how certain states perceive the situation in countries of origin. Take Afghanistan. Afghanistan, for instance, Germany right now, they do very regularly deport or return Afghan migrants back to Afghanistan. Some other states, like in France, it's much less possible so, also due to court rulings. So at the moment, a lot of Afghan migrants from Germany go to Greece, go to France, to avoid this deportation. So there are differences, and it's very unclear how this return sponsorship is fitting within a non-harmonized kind of regularization return policy in the European Union. In some countries, such as Hungary, UNHCR, even, you know, they really explicitly advised against returning any asylum seekers back because the system would be not in line with international human rights obligations. So there is unclear accountabilities, responsibilities, and a non-harmonized system in which this return sponsorship concept sits a bit squarely, let's say it like this. And then the third countries, will they play along? This is a big question. We have had in 2003, I think the first calls, and back then there was European Council in Seville. They said any association agreement should be used to make more pressure on third countries. So these are basically demands that are 20 years old, and they haven't really led to more cooperation of countries of origin. So it's not very likely to believe that this new pact will be a complete game changer just because there's a bit more money or a bit more pressure. It's more to be expected that things will go on as they used to be. So this is already the last slide coming to an end. What are the takeaway points? Return is being framed as a missing piece in the pan-European migration management system. I talk right now in particular in the internal dimension. It's a realpolitik approach of the Commission. I mean, without doubt, they said the Eastern Europeans, they called for so long for a restrictive policy. Let's give them the responsibility for restrictive policy making and let's see if they can do it. I think that's an acknowledgement of the European Commission of the current situation and the current constraints, political constraints. The risks are very high. There is a risk that this concept will only slightly reduce the polarization of the negotiations and the debates. There's also a big risk that the outcomes of very polarized negotiations will not be exactly as the Commission imagines. I mean, personally, I can see it very difficult that, you know, Hungary or Polish authorities take right now irregular migrants from Sicily or Lesbos and bring them to Budapest or Warsaw. It's politically difficult to imagine, but I mean, it's just my personal assessment. But there's also a kind of a challenging concept for migrants and for partner states, a point that Oreva, I'm sure, will talk more about. So that's already my input. I look forward then to the Q&A session, and I hope I was more or less in time.
Thank you very much, Florian. I really enjoyed listening to your presentation. So I would like to leave the word to Oreva. And if you could please keep it to 10 minutes, that would be great. Oreva.
Good evening, everyone. I think it must be evening where you are because it's afternoon where I am. I'd like to thank you for having me, extending an invitation to me through the CRC at Ryerson University, where I'm doing some research. My forthcoming short article comes from a research for working paper I did last year and some interviews I conducted in 2019 as well, relating to the experience of people who have been returned to Nigeria. So my article focuses on the state of play of EU-African migration partnerships using Nigeria as a case study. So the first thing that I want to highlight that is shaping my point of my perspective is the fact that when we talk about a partnership, it's supposed to connote voluntary cooperation and equality among partners who are supposed to be pursuing common agendas. But in reality, it's not like that if we're looking at the relationship between Europe and Africa. In the context of migration, a partnership that's stemming from the EU's externalization agenda institutionalizes the domination of countries of origin and transit by countries of destination. And the countries of destination are usually countries that have benefited from colonialism or post-colonial structures of power in the international system. This is the reason why calling for partnerships with African countries and other countries of origin, even though there's the use of the term partnership, these countries are not involved or represented in the processes that go into the EU's external migration policies. Due to time constraints, I can't really delve too much into the background of like the history of EU migration partnerships. So rather, I'll focus on some key points from my paper and implications it may have for the new pact. So the first thing, as I mentioned before, is the fact that the perspectives of African and other origin and transit countries are very important because they're the site of implementation of these numerous externalization objectives. And by gaining an understanding of how things are playing out at the ground level in these countries is more telling about whether these policies have worked, whether they will work, and what changes the EU's goals are effecting at the ground level and what these changes mean for the future. And then using Nigeria as an example, Nigeria was originally one of the first, one of the five priority countries in the migration partnership framework. And one of my interview, because I last year interviewed people who are EU officials and also people who work on EU migration policy as well. And one of the EU officials said that one of the reasons Nigeria was a prime choice was not only because of the increased influx of Nigerians, but also because the EU saw Nigeria as a country that would be open for partnership and a country that would give the quick results that European political leaders desperately needed around the time where migration was having this politicization in Europe. So even though Nigeria was one of the first countries to subscribe to the Common Agenda for Migration and Mobility in 2015, things didn't really work out the way the EU envisioned. And this is because the reality on ground in Nigeria and Nigeria's political and economic interests don't really match the interests of the EU. One of the migration partnership, the drive for migration partnership with Nigeria has yielded some positive outcomes. For example, Nigeria has been able to achieve a national migration policy, which it didn't have before, with the funding from the EUTF and EDF. However, the problem is that even though all these structures, like we now have a labor policy, we have a diaspora policy, the problem is that return and reintegration is not well coordinated, monitored, or followed up at the ground level in Nigeria. So even if you're having people being returned, research has shown that many people who were returned, either voluntarily or not, they either migrated again or have plans to migrate again. And this is from the research of other people, as well as interviews I conducted in 2019. Out of the 10 people who were returned that I spoke to, 9 of them had plans to return to Europe. And the only person who said he wasn't going to return was someone who had, before he left, he had a job in Nigeria that was paying him. And when he came back, he had a supportive network that he could fall back to. But all the other people, the return measures didn't really stop their migration goals, because they came back to meet the things that drove them out in the first place. In addition to that, even though Nigeria has this policy framework, because of a lack of implementation issues, which is rooted in lack of ownership of the migration governance initiatives, because the EU collaborates with international organizations like the IOM and the UNHCR to lead these initiatives, rather than directly giving responsibility to the Nigerian government to initiate these things. So because of that, there's kind of, there's no federal involvement, government involvement in any of these things. There's no federal budget, as well as the government, beyond engagements with the IOM, it's not really trickling down to other levels of government. And aside from that, one of the negative impacts is of the funding is that it's creating not only hierarchies between different international organizations, but also there's competition between the Nigerian at the federal level and state level agencies for funding. And the problem is that the funding is needed at the ground level more so than at the national level, because that's where, you know, individuals and communities, that's where the problems give rise to, that's where people find the push to leave the country. So if you have funding that is only hitting at the national level, and it's not really trickling down to civil society and other groups that are directly involved with people who are interested in migrating, then there's no real effectiveness of any of these initiatives. Another important point, which has been reiterated in a lot of work, is about how a lot of African countries are not, they don't gain anything from collaborating with return and readmission agreements, because they benefit from remittances. Nigeria in particular is the largest recipient of remittances in the continent. So there's really no reason why the country should be anti-migration. You know, the government is very pro-migration because it's benefiting from remittances. Another important point is Nigeria prefers bilateral agreements over multilateral ones. And this has impacted Nigeria's choices in terms of how much it collaborates with the EU. The EU being a multilateral institution, the Nigerian government sees that if they agree to EU, what's the word, to EU pressure or to EU suggestions, whatever is agreed upon will be replicated in all the EU member states and their relationship with Nigeria. But if Nigeria focuses more on bilateral agreements that are based on distinct issues and the personal relationship it has with specific member states, then there's more leverage for Nigeria. So Nigeria has more benefit interfacing with a particular member state than with the EU as a whole. Another point is that internal context and realities influence how the impact of any of these EU initiatives. So in Nigeria, the interests that, as I said before, interests at national level differ from state level. And this shapes how whether or not implementation takes place, how funding is spent, what issues become prioritized by the government, etc. And the reason why all these things are important is because at the EU level, there are all these talks about doing, putting pressure, giving incentives. But if you don't consider what is the sub-national level nuances, the changes that are happening at, beyond the national level because of these things, then it becomes a process that's not realistic. A good example is you have funding for migration that goes to a ministry at the national level. At the national level, they choose to put that money into something about diaspora affairs because that's what at the national level, that's what the interest is. But at the state level, there's this Edo State in Nigeria is a state that has a lot of issues with human trafficking. So that's what that state is interested in, but the funds don't get to address that particular issue because the decision is made at a higher level. Another point is that Nigeria is very much interested in legal pathways, but this is not something that has been focused on in the discussions about return or migration partnership in general. It has been more about just returning people rather than creating ways for people to move legally. And because Nigeria has political and strategic interests in remittance streams, the EU will have to consider that when coming up with these new approaches to dealing with migration. To conclude, I just want to list some points because I think I'm reaching the end of my 10 minutes. The language of partnerships is something that has been shrouding, like it shrouds asymmetries of power, and the relationship between origin and destination countries still mimic post-colonial hierarchies. Migration partnerships or the push for migration partnerships are still used to maximize or further EU externalization goals and uphold a system that is exploiting the weaknesses of African countries and also ignoring the political and economic realities of these countries. And if you ignore those realities, then the end goal is never going to be achieved. A focus on return remains inimical to the idea of a partnership because it means that there is less consideration of legal pathways. And as discussed in Professor Troner's paper, the pact does not really go into much detail on legal pathways. And then the idea of the return sponsorship also relies on cooperation of these of non-EU countries, and many of them, like Nigeria, are very unwilling to readmit their nationals. So in the end, what does that mean? It's not going to lead to anything concrete in the end. Also, a focus on return puts strains relationships with African countries because it does not consider the things that they value or the things they have interest in. The EU is better off focusing on the long term, on cooperation in the long term, rather than immediate political interests. And for those long term goals to be possible, the EU have to collaborate and with origin and transit countries based on not only EU interests, but also African or other origin and transit countries' strategic interests. And the final point I wanted to make was that this continuing focus on returns also has implications for migrants' rights, because it has progressively led to a reduction of the regard or the, respect of protection of migrants' rights. And I think that this is a place where African governments and regional organizations like the African Union and ECOWAS can play a role in pushing back, because there is an international legal framework which EU countries and the EU itself, you know, has stakes in, you know, things that have been, a lot of international legal norms have stemmed from the EU context. So those countries should be held to those standards as well. Yeah, I think I'll stop there, because I must have gone over my time.
Thank you very much, Oreva. So it was very interesting to listen to your insight on the matter. And I think that the two presentations also well complemented each other. So first we had an overview of the background of the return sponsorship mechanism, but also how it works in practice and what are some of the challenges within the EU and among member states. And then we had a broader perspective, taking the view of partner countries and also a reflection on how this might actually perpetuate asymmetric relationships. So I would like to thank very much both Florian and Oreva for their insights. Just because we are stretched a little bit with time, I would propose, if you agree, to move on to the Q&A section. And I would like to invite the speakers to feel free to respond or to comment upon the remarks of the other speaker during the Q&A, if that's all right. So I would like, yes, to invite the audience to pose any questions. So if you would like to use the raise hand function, you can then ask your questions directly to the speakers, or you could also ask it in the chat. So I see we have a question from Isabella. Would you like to ask it yourself, Isabella, or shall I read it out?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Great. Thank you so much. So for the sake of time, I just wanted to leave it in the chat, but great. Many thanks for inviting me to ask it orally. So a question, actually, I have a question to Florian. And in terms of the current internal discussions, both in the parliament, in the council, on the AMR, what recommendations actually would you make to them in terms of the written sponsorship? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Isabella. Great to see you and to engage with you. I know that you're yourself a big expert on these issues. I mean, you know, what kind of recommendation? I think from my perspective, you could say that the probably biggest challenge in European migration management is still to help the border countries if everything else is there. And I don't think you can avoid physically bringing people away from the states. So I do, from my personal perspective, is that the European Parliament should ensure that the help for the border states becomes tangible and predictable. This can be both to relocation, but also to the return sponsorship, if you want to go there. I think the big risk is that the concept as it stands is too fluffy, too broad, to everything. Also, I mean, the solidarity mechanism more widely, that at the end, much of the responsibility for, in particular, the asylum protection in Europe remains with border countries. So I think a focus of the European Parliament should be that there is really help. I mean, politically, this implies to go against the Visegrad countries, to go against a few other states. And I think this was the objective of the European Commission to avoid, and they went a long way. But it's I think no matter how far they went there, they are so opposed to general, you know, with any way of solidarity, that in a way I'm asking myself if it's not just better to go away and make it clear and to risk that they even outvoted in the council in the end.
Thanks, Florian. Sarah, perhaps we can take a couple of questions together. Yes, Sarah.
Aiko and Katarina had their hands up before, so I want to yield the floor to them.
Oh, sorry. I thought you were the first.
No worries. Go ahead, Sarah. Happy to wait.
Katarina, to you then.
We have a couple of questions together, so Katarina and Sarah can ask together. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. I have actually a question about the positive and negative conditionalities, and also I got the impression that this new return sponsorship is very much focused on solving the internal problems within the EU, like to solve the problems around the relocation mechanism. But all of this depends also on the fact that actually these irregular migrants are in the end returned to the countries of origin. So I was wondering, to what extent is this also tackled or part of the debate? Because if I'm informed correctly, no readmission agreements have been concluded with any of the North African countries in the past years, even though these mobility partnerships were concluded, but no progress has been made, or like the negotiations are stalled or still ongoing. And then more towards the negative conditionality, I understood correctly that this is also something that is quite often recommended in the academic literature, that the EU has to use negative conditionality more effectively or in a more coherent way. But why do you think that it will not be efficient in the end?
Thanks, Katarina. Sarah.
I have, I think, maybe a broader, more conceptual question for both of you, Florian and Areva, and thank you so much for your presentations. It's around this idea of solidarity, because my understanding is that it seems like the EU is thinking about solidarity in these policies and in the new pact as something that is inter and intra EU member states. But then kind of keeping in mind what Areva was saying about how this is potentially retrenching these kind of colonial, you know, asymmetrical relationships that historically speaking have resulted in a great deal of oppression and suffering that, you know, has then in turn motivated some of this migration in the first place. Is there space to think about this as solidarity with these countries of origin and transit as well? Are people in the EU thinking about it in that sense? Can there be a kind of conceptual expansion of solidarity, or is that already happening and it's just not getting messaged out to, you know, lay people like me who are reading the news?
Thanks, Sarah. Aiko, would you like to, perhaps we can take the three questions together?
Yes, I'm very happy to chip in. Thank you very much for your presentations, Areva and Florian. I think I would like to ask two questions. I guess the question to Areva is really, I guess, about the interests and the priorities of African countries in this relationship. You talked a little bit about, I guess, the importance of legal pathways, right? The role of remittances and keeping remittance flows going and so on. I was also, I guess, wondering to what extent there are interests beyond the migration field that are priorities for African countries in this context. So to what extent, I guess, issues of market access and trade or aid issues are also part of these conversations. And to Florian, I guess, building partly on what Katarina was saying, obviously for me, and obviously you know that I'm skeptical about this notion of flexible solidarity that the pact promotes. And I guess my key concern really is that if we are thinking about states being asked to make voluntary contributions, right, to the broader EU effort in terms of both protection and return, how those voluntary contribution mechanisms would work, right? When we think back to our experience about relocation, as you said, but also in terms of Dublin transfers and so on, right? Whenever, I guess, voluntary contributions were at stake, those contributions were often not forthcoming. And I still can't quite see how this would work in practice. And I wonder whether you have more confidence than I have that would suggest that we might actually move forward through this concept of flexible solidarity in the end.
Thanks, Eiko. So I leave the word to Florian first. Yes.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks to all three of you for very interesting questions. I will start with this idea or with this question on third countries and positive negative conditionality. And if negative conditionality is efficient, I mean, what we see is, or let's say differently, if you look right now from the perspective of member states, you can see that if you use negative conditionality at European Union level fully, and you know the full potential there, if you impose visa sanctions, this is very costly. This will affect the overall relations of the European Union with a certain state. And let's think, I mean, very carefully, France, they are engaged in a big counterterrorism or operation in the Sahel. They have huge economic interest vis-a-vis many, you know, former colonies. For them, it's very risky to put all their weight behind a European Union approach that that is very punchy and prioritizes return over other foreign policy issues. De facto diplomats, they don't want to do this. It's very clear. I mean, that's why they haven't done it in the past. The tools have already been there prior. I mean, right now they are more refined. They touch upon other policy fields, but also in previous days, in previous years, you could do more than the European Union did. And why? What was the reason? Because member states didn't fully back the Commission on the European Union level. Key member states didn't back them when it was clear. And you always have this kind of, you know, Spain, Mauritania, Italy, Libya, Tunisia, France. So you have these key players. And if they don't go along, the European Union will struggle to do it fully. I think that's one of the responses there. And then the solidarity with third countries. I think you can say in the European Union, solidarity is a legal concept enshrined in treaties. In the asylum fields is you know, Article 80 in the treaties. So there is really an obligation there. And the relocation, the mechanism was set up into being with a reference to these legal obligations. Internationally, it's a political will. You can do, but you don't have to do it, basically. I mean, UNHCR asks member states and, I mean, Western OECD countries more broadly, over and over to do more in the resettlement of refugees from conflict zones. And it's very much to the will of governments to do it or to not do it. I mean, Trump completely stopped it for the USA. In the EU, you have, you know, I mean, it's differing according to the member states, but it's basically, you know, up to the individual member states to decide how to show solidarity at international level. I think that would be my response here. And then to Eiko's question about the voluntariness, quite interestingly, in a webinar with Italian authorities, the concern about this new pact was that the result will be actually worse than what is achieved right now with the multi-initiatives or with other things. This were basically the multi-initiatives is a voluntary initiative of a few member states saying every time when a boat full of migrants arrives in Italy, we distribute them, you know. And for Italian authority, they say it's voluntarily, nobody obliges them to do it, but de facto it's working relatively smoothly and we have predictable outcomes. And they say right now with this concept, member states may hide behind this commission coordinator, behind these more legalized terms, and you are in permanent negotiations. So you could also have an outcome that shifting right now from voluntary action to more legalized action achieves the opposite of what the Commission seeks to achieve, that that is tangible results. I don't know. I mean, it's sometimes really difficult to say. I mean, what we have seen in all of the recent years is if governments of member states really don't want to do anything, they don't do anything. And you can have infringement, you can cases. It's very difficult to make them move in this area in a way.
Thank you, Florian, also for addressing each of the questions in such detail. Oreva, I leave the word to you.
Thanks for the questions. I think I will address the question about solidarity first. I think the problem is that it's been focused mostly on funding. So using funding as like to cover building an actual relationship with the countries of origin and transit. So the problem is that money is not the only issue. So throwing money to focus on creating job opportunities, all those things are fine. But if you don't allow these countries to lead these different initiatives, then the relationship is still not equal. So for example, in Nigeria, you have international organizations or people from the EU or EU member states leading migration governance initiatives that are funded by the EU. And you don't have any Nigerian in any of these top positions. You don't have Nigerians involved in the planning processes. You just have them at the lower levels, you know, implementing whatever has been decided at the top. So in that way, people are very disconnected to this whole idea of collaboration, of a true partnership where the two sides are supposed to be sharing a common agenda or working towards a common goal. I don't think that really exists. It just feels like, oh, there's more money for this. Let's use the money. And that's the extent of the cooperation. And it could be much better if people within the countries of origin and transit are leading these initiatives. And then aside from that, relating to the question about whether countries like Nigeria have other interests outside of migration. Yes, Nigeria is very much interested in having better market access and things like better diplomatic and cultural exchanges. Educational exchanges are also very important. And it's the reason why Nigeria has a certain, China has a certain appeal to Nigeria and other African countries, because China provides those kind of things. Whereas you have the countries in the global north, like the US and then the EU countries that take a more, I don't know how to describe it, but it's like a stance of we're doing you a favor, you know, where whatever we give to you, it's you know, you're benefiting from us, not the other way around. Although I have to say remittance is very, very important, because as of last month, Nigeria now pays you if you get money from outside. So if someone sends you dollars, you get money from the government per how many dollars that you're receiving from outside. That's how much Nigerian government values remittances. So I think that will remain like a key interest, but I think things like cultural, educational, diplomatic exchanges are very, very important as well. Yeah, I don't remember the other, I don't know if I've answered. Yeah, good question.
Yes, I think so. Thank you, Reva. We might have time for one last quick question. So Catherine, would you like to ask a question?
Yeah, thank you so much, Matilda, and thank you, Florian and Oreva, for really fascinating talks. In part, my questions has already been answered, but I've been thinking about this concept of migration diplomacy, which has been used by Fiona Adamson and other people to explain, sort of in much more international relations realist terms, the relationships that I'm, you know, hearing being described here between the EU and African countries, which is kind of, you know, described as partnership, a term which is thrown around, but really quite empty, as Oreva, you were saying. So I guess that my question was similar to Aiko's, in terms of if you think in real terms, and let's not talk about the humanitarian and sort of migrant perspective dimension of this, but you know, if the EU seems to be in a fairly weak bargaining or diplomatic position vis-a-vis, you know, the origin countries, are there things that the EU can offer that multilateral diplomatic relations couldn't? And I guess one of your answers here was, you know, market access. So I suppose my question has been answered, but the migration diplomacy framework seems really interesting here, and I was wondering if you've thought about it. Thank you.
Would you like to comment on that, Oreva?
Yeah, I think in terms, another area is scholarships. I remember one of my interviews, someone mentioned that having more scholarships available to people from origin and transit countries is a way to kind of diplomatically allow for more exchanges between the two without having, you know, to focus so much on returning people. So if, for example, using Nigeria as an example, the problem with Nigeria is that most of the people who wouldn't qualify for the high standards of legal pathways that the EU or EU member states have, because they have skills that are considered low level. So creating opportunities for people to upgrade their skills to the point where they can then get on these, meet the higher requirements for migration is a way to navigate the problems that are existing in the relationship between the EU and Nigeria's migration dialogue. And aside from that, another aspect is, I kind of lost my train of thought, but basically it's, The biggest issue in the migration partnership relationship is the fact that African and other like origin and transit countries are not put in a position where they feel like they are valued in the exchange. It's always the EU coming up with the rules, coming up with the procedures, and then these countries are just places where those goals are implemented, you know, and if it continues like that, there's no diplomacy there. You know, if it's just one side constantly determining the direction that something is supposed to go to.
Thank you, Oreva. Florian, would you like to add something to this? I guess it was more for Oreva, the question, but would you like to add some final thoughts before we conclude?
I just very briefly outline, I am currently working on a research project in which we compared the return rate worldwide for 12 years. And it's quite interesting to see that the return rate was decreasing for basically every region over the time period, regardless of the EU trying more and more conditionalities. The only exception were the Western Balkans and Eastern Europe. And I mean, a hypothesis could be that one way to make third countries cooperate more on return is to facilitate the access to the territory, as it's counterintuitive. But in these regions, they had this visa liberalization process. So also psychologically, the states felt no longer being excluded from Europe in a way, in particular in traveling. And I think then the governments accepted this wider bargaining, you know, you cooperate and return, but then the wide part of the population can go back and forth, and we are more or less on an equal level. And I think that is something to keep in mind. It's a bit counterintuitive, but facilitating, making it more normal to travel may actually be the biggest advantage the EU has if it wants to stimulate more cooperation of third countries.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this relates also to what Areva was saying earlier with regards to legal pathways, either through those or through visa liberalization or facilitation. Yes, thank you very much. I would like to thanks from myself, but also from everyone here attending, Areva and Florian, for joining the discussion today. It was really very, very interesting to hear your insights. And so I would like to thank you for joining. And also thank you to every one of you in the audience for being here tonight. So I hope you have a very nice evening. And do check out the publications by Florian and Areva on the topics. Thank you.